the subtle of touches.
Hello and welcome to The Wire, independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station. I'm Ollie Henderson. Coming up on The Wire today...
It's a bill that effectively allows people to put a sign on their window saying, no gays.
As Australia waits for the results of the same-sex marriage survey, set to be announced tomorrow, politicians in Canberra have been busy drafting the legislation in anticipation for a yes vote. But not all legislation is created equally. Also on The Wire today...
We're very interested in hearing about your ideas and your aspirations and looking at how we can support them.
Indigenous Business Australia is gearing up to inject $50 million of investment into businesses that support Indigenous communities. The government agency hopes that the initiative will deliver more employment and mentoring opportunities for the burgeoning businesses in remote and regional Australia. Stay tuned for all this and more coming up on The Wire. The almost daily announcement of senators and MPs who are finding themselves in dual citizenship hot water continues today with the resignation of a very emotional Senator Jackie Lambie.
But for now, I just want to say thank you. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to be in here. And I tell you guys aren't as bad as I all say, although I'll keep telling you that.
Of course, the question is, who will be replacing her as the Jackie Lambie Network's senator? Roderick Chambers put this to Dr. Stuart Jackson, lecturer in politics at the University of Sydney.
That's really interesting. Her number two, Steve Marson, was a local councillor at the time of his nomination, so that may well be tested as well.
Oh.
He may not be actually eligible himself. There is a whole series of these sorts of issues that may suddenly spring up now. But in terms of Lambie, actually for Jackie it's really interesting because she's been going through the process of registering her party in Tasmania. So she may well run in Tasmania as a Tasmanian politician, where she would be able to.
Oh, I see. A bit like Malcolm Roberts in Queensland.
Yes. Yes, very much so.
If he's not eligible, the second on the ticket, because he worked for a local council, who would be following him?
There is a number three. I believe his name's Rob Waterhouse. And I can't remember directly off my mind. And then the question that it cascades through all of these, unfortunately. But I think it should go. If Martin is tested and found not to be eligible as a local councillor, then it would move on again. And the third person would again be most likely to be elected. We'd have to test that and see it when it goes through the recount. But the likelihood is it would just go down the list. Of course, because if that person's not eligible, then it would go elsewhere.
Because the Senate, as I recall, the Senate in Victoria, in Tasmania, was quite tight, wasn't it? So would there be anyone that would be wanting to contest this?
I imagine the McCulloch, the One Nation person who missed out to Nick McKim by only a few hundred votes at the last cut. So they would almost certainly be up for a challenge. They'd certainly wish to see themselves as want to be part of the High Court challenge because it's actually a potential One Nation seat.
And we've got some of the top people on the Liberal hit list, I think, is Justine Key, who's actually kind of already ruled herself ineligible anyway because she said that she didn't get the confirmation in time, didn't she?
Yes, that's correct. It appears that she may or may not be eligible. She didn't get the confirmation until after the nomination date. It's going to start to turn on things like, well, when did the decision actually get made in Britain that she was no longer a citizen? She'd started the process before. And, of course, this means that people are essentially held up to the vagaries of another country, which the High Court's already commented on. The issue is going to be, of course, is she actually ineligible because she hadn't received the confirmation and therefore should not have nominated? And that's what the High Court's going to then have to have a look at. I suspect, given their really, you know, more black-letter law approach, the literal translation last time of the Constitution, they will probably go, no, you haven't renounced, therefore you're out.
And is Susan Lamb in that similar situation? It might be interesting if there's a by-election in Longman, because that used to be Wyatt Roy's seat, didn't it?
Yes, it did. Well, this is where I come in. It's going to cascade through a whole series of seats, depending on the nuances that the High Court goes for. And this is part of the problem that it's set itself up for. It's made itself what it thinks is fairly strict, but then now everybody's going to be testing, well, what exactly does that mean? I think it could be very interesting in Longman. That said, if the current polling that people have been bandying around, particularly in seats like Dutton's seat, where he would lose the next election, then maybe Longman would stay with the Labor Party.
So you have mentioned the other big announcement today was that Christina Keneally would be running for the seat. In fact, here's Malcolm Turnbull's reaction to Christina Keneally's nomination as he was asked in the press conference in Vietnam today.
Christina Keneally, OK. My message to the voters of Bennelong is you have an outstanding local member, John Alexander, who has delivered for Bennelong. Don't let Christina Keneally do to Bennelong what she did to New South Wales.
In your frank discussion with...
Well, 10% swing required. John Alexander increased his margin at the last election. It'll be an interesting contest because of the demographics, large Chinese population, Chinese-speaking population in the area. They may well be upset by the stuff around refugees, around border protection. So that may well be, and some of the, if you like, anti-immigrant commentary coming out of some of the members of the coalition, particularly around purchasing of Australian property. So that may cause people to say, well, perhaps I don't like this other government. Perhaps we'll go with the Labor Party, go to the Labor Party. The question will be is how much of Christina Keneally's state baggage will she then have to carry? I mean, she has said previously that she's no one's little woman in reference to Labor power brokers, OB and Tripodi et al., McDonald and co. Nonetheless, that baggage is going to come out all through the election period, and everything's going to be made of John Alexander, the tennis great, and all the rest.
But do you think there could be an early election?
Oh, I definitely think there could be an early election. I think we could see a change of leadership. Turnbull's not covered himself in any kind of glory in the last few months. It's been travail after travail for him. I think the same-sex marriage bills that come forward are going to be another test of his leadership. I can see a raft of amendments to the Senate. I would expect it to be difficult. I would be surprised almost to see if he survived to next year in terms of being the leader of the Liberal Party and thus Prime Minister.
Dr. Stuart Jackson, lecturer in politics at the University of Sydney, ending that report by Roderick Chambers. The New South Wales government have drafted a bill that could allow authorities to detain prisoners beyond their sentence period if they are suspected of radicalisation. Greens MP David Shoebridge is concerned that this may undermine the justice system, as it will be sentencing people based on their potential to commit a crime rather than a crime they have already committed. The New South Wales government are proposing to extend current terrorism laws so that radicalised and dangerous offenders will find it harder to get parole. Premier Gladys Berejiklian said that criminals could be locked up in New South Wales prisons if they pose an unacceptable risk of committing serious terrorism offences after completing their sentences. I spoke with the president of the Law Society of New South Wales, Pauline Wright, about how this new legislation would affect prisoners. How is this different from the parole that already exists?
There are two things. There's a sentence, which is the maximum sentence that you must serve, is imposed by a court. The court will usually set a non-parole period, which is shorter than the maximum sentence. Say you get a 5-year sentence, but you get a non-parole period of 3 years. That means that you must serve your 5 years. But for that 2 years, you're on parole. You're out in the community, but you're on parole. And there's a supervision by the parole authority. So that's the difference between a sentence and the parole period. What's being proposed here is not that. It is after someone's served the full sentence, they can be held for a further period just in case they might commit another crime once they're released from jail.
Do you think that this undermines the due process of the courts, given that people are potentially going to be locked up for future crimes?
Absolutely. Sentencing is the role of the court. It's subject to rules of evidence and it's determined after a consideration of all of that according to law. And it's a really fundamental principle that once people have served their time, they should be free to go, subject to appropriate supervision pending their reintegration into society.
Do you think there's a big issue of radicalisation within the prison system?
There are dangers of radicalisation within jails, and what we should be doing is putting resources into combating that potential influence while people are in jail and into rehabilitation programs so that when people do come out, they have a really good chance of being productive members of the community again.
As I understand, there's a similar law that already exists in federal legislation. Has this been used a lot before? Is this already happening?
Continuing detention orders are already in place. The Law Society of New South Wales has consistently opposed continuing detention orders. And the reason for that is it's a fundamental principle in any democracy that people shouldn't be held in jail unless they've been convicted and sentenced for a serious crime, or if they're facing a serious charge and maybe they're a flight risk or something else that means that they don't get bail. That's the only time you should be jailed, is if you've been convicted of an offence or you've had bail refused. To hold people on suspicion that they might commit an offence is dangerous. It's really hard to predict an offender's future conduct. So how do we decide who is and who isn't at risk of committing a future offence?
What kind of behaviour do you think that people will be looking out for to put someone in the category of a risk of a future offence?
No doubt there would have to be an assessment by an expert or a psychiatrist, likely. Other experts would be giving their opinion of that. But as I say, that is notoriously difficult. And how do you prove if that person is wrong? If that expert is wrong, how do you prove that? Because what you're doing is, in fact, locking someone up, potentially indefinitely, in case they might offend.
Do you think that this legislation will be applied to other states around the country as well?
I'm sure that other states are looking at this kind of thing, and it's something that we would really oppose. There are other options. For instance, serious offenders could benefit from reintegration home detention, that is, being confined to home as a bridge between release from jail and release into the community, and having supervision once they're in the community. That is much more effective and doesn't offend against that rule that you should be at liberty unless you've committed an offence and been convicted for it.
Why do you think these laws are being introduced now?
There's a perception in the community that we're at risk, and the Law Society obviously acknowledges that safety of the community is a priority of government, but that shouldn't be at the expense of fundamental principles of democracy. We don't want to see our democracy ruined because of fear.
President of the New South Wales Law Society, Pauline Wright, ending that report.
Oh, look at that waterhole. Isn't that cool?
Ecotourism has proved to be a big success in many areas of Australia. And Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander businesses are starting to see the benefits. Yesterday, a new $50 million program was announced from Indigenous Business Australia to help nurture great ideas that Indigenous people and groups are having to start new businesses or expand existing ones. Roderick Chambers asked the CEO of Indigenous Business Australia, Rajiv Vishwanathan, just what this idea of impact investing was all about.
So globally, we're seeing a real interest in what's called impact investing. So that's making investments that deliver a financial return, but also, importantly, social outcomes. In yep. our case, this money is to invest in ventures that provide for Indigenous ownership of businesses and assets that deliver commercial returns, but also that will drive employment, small business and other social outcomes for Indigenous communities in Australia.
With the launch of this fund, is there already a sort of a pipeline of Indigenous businesses that are sort of lining up to see if they can access it?
Well, IBA has been doing investing with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander organisations since it was founded in 1990, so we have a long history in this space. With this new money, what we're really trying to do is encourage organisations to come forward with their ideas and also to look at ways of leveraging private sector capital. So there has been interest. There are some opportunities in the pipeline, and even in the short amount of time since we announced this, we've seen significant interest.
And do you actually help Indigenous businesses get extra financing, or do you have any sort of advice and infrastructure attached to this?
That's right. So for these investments, the way IBA typically works is we'll put our capital in alongside the Indigenous organisation to the extent it can contribute. We then look to bring in private sector and industry expertise, either through their investment or through their management roles in the assets. We will typically establish a board that then will oversee the business or the investment, and on that board we'll appoint people with industry and business expertise to help steer and grow the business. Outside this initiative, IBA also runs a small business and entrepreneurship program, and we provide startup capital and support for smaller and startup businesses as well.
What sort of ventures can you point to that have been a success for you in the past?
In terms of investments, we've had a lot of success, particularly in tourism. So we've invested in tourism businesses, for example, in Kakadu, as well as in the Flinders Ranges. And those are businesses where we've acquired them from private owners, but in partnership with Indigenous organisations. And then over time, IBA looks to introduce Indigenous employment, cultural tours, small business opportunities. And the idea is over a 7 to 10 year period, the Aboriginal organisation should end up owning and running the business itself. A recent example is Cicada Lodge in Katherine. So we built that as a greenfields development in 2013 in a partnership with Nitmaluk, which is a local Indigenous organisation. We then launched it, opened it, introduced Indigenous jobs, and Nitmaluk ended up buying out IBA and now runs that business successfully in its own right. So our typical model is intended to ensure long-term ownership and control of the business by our Indigenous partners.
And I'm just wondering, like, often people don't realise what they've got. Can you help the group that's there that perhaps have a specialist knowledge, Indigenous knowledge of an area, develop that into a marketable commodity for an overseas market?
Yes, we can. So this fund is targeted at established businesses that we want to acquire and layer in Indigenous impact.
Mm-hmm.
But we also do a lot of work supporting entrepreneurs and communities that want to start up businesses. And so what you described is absolutely in the sweet spot of what we do. An organization or a community or an entrepreneur can come to us with their idea, and we will sit down with them, understand where they want to take that idea and their business, and we will provide business support as well as startup capital to get those sort of opportunities going and growing.
And I presume this is available anywhere in Australia. If you are listening to this program and you think, gee, I've got some ideas that might be worthwhile bringing to the IBA, what were the process did you go through?
So visit our website, iba.gov.au, and get a sense of what we're offering. We have 14 offices around the country, including in many regional and even remote locations. And then there's also a 1-800 number that they can contact to find out more. So we've got many channels through which we engage, and we actually get out and visit communities as well. So we're very interested in hearing about your ideas and your aspirations and looking at how we can support them.
Indigenous Business Australia's Rajiv Vishwanathan ending that report by Roderick Chambers. The results of the postal survey on marriage equality will be announced at 10 a.m. tomorrow morning. As millions of Australians are holding their breath, waiting for the results, our politicians have been drafting legislation in preparation for a potential yes. But what will this same-sex marriage bill look like?
If there is a yes vote announced tomorrow, then the private members' bill will be debated and people will be free to move whatever amendments they want, and they'll be debated and voted on and determined.
That was Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull at a press conference in Manila earlier today. If tomorrow's postal survey results on marriage equality come back a yes, this means that our politicians will be deciding exactly what that marriage looks like and the surrounding circumstances. I caught up with long-term LGBTQI plus advocate Rodney Crome to reflect on the campaign and try to understand the bills that have been proposed. Tomorrow will be a big day for many same-sex attracted people and their friends and family as the postal survey will be announced. How are you feeling about tomorrow?
Like tens of thousands of other LGBTI people across Australia, I think I'm a bit anxious. I'm on the edge of my seat waiting for what the result is. I'm hopeful that'll be a yes vote. That's what all the polls show. But it's not just a question of yes or no. How big the yes vote will be important in coming debates about legislation. And I'll also be watching the result in my home state of Tasmania, because I've put a lot of effort in there in Tasmania to try and achieve a yes vote. So I'll be looking for the big picture result, but also looking at some of the detail as well, because that will be important.
And you've been advocating for LGBTI rights for decades, working on a variety of things, including the decriminalisation of homosexuality in Tasmania. How does the marriage equality campaign compare to fights from the past?
In terms of the similarities, many of the arguments that have been run during the postal survey against marriage equality echo the arguments against previous LGBTI equality reforms. You can predict pretty safely, I think, that those people who don't want us to be equal will not actually address the issue. And that's certainly been the case during the postal survey. They haven't actually addressed the issue of whether same-sex couples should be able to get married. Instead, they've sought to press a whole lot of hot-button culture issues like sex education in school, like religious freedom and freedom of speech. They've been trying to distract away from the issue of marriage equality because they know that they've lost that argument. They know that a majority of Australians support that reform. It was exactly the same in Tasmania in the 1990s. They knew they couldn't argue for the laws that were in place then that criminalised sex between men, in consenting adult men in private. So instead they made it all about children, all about freedom, all about religion, about anything else. So that's always the case. But of course, one big difference is that the nation is voting on this.
And if the yes vote does go through tomorrow, what can we expect from there?
In a perfect world, we would see a very simple and straightforward piece of legislation put to Parliament, preferably by the Prime Minister, who was the one who wanted this postal survey, that changed the definition of marriage in the Marriage Act from a man and a woman to two people. That's what was changed in 2004 to entrench or to ban same-sex marriage under the Howard government, and it's all that needs to change now, to change back to just saying two people, with an extra proviso to make sure that ministers of religion don't have to marry same-sex couples. That's all that's needed.
Do you want to just quickly give us a little rundown of the different bills that are put forward?
One bill's come forward from Senator Dean Smith, who's openly gay liberal from WA. And that bill allows people who have a religious view to discriminate. So civil celebrants who have religious objections to particular kinds of marriages are now able to nominate themselves as traditional marriage celebrants, which means that they can turn away anyone they want. They don't have to marry them, including same-sex couples. And it also puts in place a provision that allows religious organisations not to have to provide their services to same-sex couples. And that includes any commercial services, catering services or whatever that might have a religious link. But then, of course, we have a bill from Senator James Patterson, a Liberal from Victoria, who is a supporter of marriage equality, but also very strongly of religious freedom. And he's put forward a bill which is just mind-blowingly awful from my point of view, because it punches huge holes in anti-discrimination law by allowing service providers, any business where the owner may have sort of particular religious views or conscientious objection. They don't even have to be religious. They can just be that he or she doesn't like same-sex relationships, or any charity or anybody really, to be able to refuse their services to same-sex couples. It's a bill that effectively allows people to put a sign on their window saying, no gays. My fear is that it's been put forward in order to try and complicate the debate, to delay the reform and to kick the issue down the road.
How long do you think this will drag on out for?
I understand the government has said that it's not going to favour one bill or the other. It's just going to let the process take its course. And that makes me anxious. That makes me feel like the government's just going to let it drag on and on. And I'd really like to see some leadership from the government, particularly the Prime Minister, who's put us through this whole process, for him to say, OK, we favour one bill over the other, say the Smith bill, because I think that has much more support amongst his colleagues, and we're going to put that to the Parliament and we're going to get it done by Christmas, which is what he has said previously during the postal survey, but he really needs to step up now and make sure that the process is as swift and as painless as possible. Otherwise, this will just get lost and will drag on into next year and potentially up to the election.
Brodney Croom ending that report. And that's it for The Wire today. I'm Ollie Henderson, and thank you for your company.
Well-pressed and well-dressed, you can't see any of that, though, because this is radio.
2SER.com.
Like buying, we just like time on the phone, we just like feeling, faces like time that will fade away.